Hey, Mark, look, it's take three already. It's time for this extra question
and
answer.
It came around so fast.
It's almost like we haven't moved. How many cups of coffee have you had already?
Three. Well, no, I had two at your house.
Yes.
It's five.
What's your limit?
Oh, I don't have a limit.
Do you know, do you just keep going?
I just keep going.
Can your ticker take it, though?
Yeah, my ticker take it. I know these people say, I can't drink coffee after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because I won't sleep. I could, quite literally, mate, wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, drink a double espresso and go straight back to sleep.
Because that was always that weird thing, you know, end of the meal. Someone said, can I get you an espresso? No.
No.
Of course not, because I would just be awake.
Yeah, but...
Unless you're Mark and you have the constitution of an ox.
I have got a strong constitution.
You absolutely have.
I'm still trying to figure out what this wretched Neil Sedaka song is that I got from...
Oh, that's from our take one.
I know, but yeah, but if people have got here, I imagine they will have heard the first bits. You know, we're down the far-off cul-de-sac of, of life, you know. I can't...
I think The Hungry Years, by the way, is one. It's a really original song from a brilliant songwriter. The idea of someone missing the times when
they were poor.
I miss The Hungry Years. When it was when we were really struggling, and now we're really well off and it's fine, but I missed The Hungry Years. I thought it was really interesting.
No, yeah, it's genius.
Anyway, we're not here to rabbit. We're here to answer your questions and schmestions, or if you were to put it musically.
Questions, schmestions.
Just to be different, I'm going to start with the schmestions, if that's right with you. We are speaking here on the day after Valentine's Day.
Yes.
Ellie...
Did you get Valentine's Day from the good lady ceramicist?
Yes.
You got a card?
Yes. Ellie and Air...
Yes, I did too. Thanks for asking.
Did you get... I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I didn't get a card from the good lady ceramicist.
Well, it's because you were at my house.
You had a bottle of champagne.
You know, it was Night Timber. It was English, so it's not champagne, but it's sort of counts for more.
Oh, but the shape of the bottle looked like a champagne bottle, yeah.
Anyway, so romance is in the air. Ellie, in air, says, what's the most romantic thing you've ever done?
Do you want to go first or?
I can go first.
Okay.
I proposed on Valentine's Day.
Did you?
Yes. With Mozart's 20th piano concerto, the second movie, which is the Romanza.
You put on accompaniment to the proposal?
Yes.
Wowza.
Does that count? That counts, doesn't it?
Wow.
Okay.
That's amazing. You literally set the whole thing. Did you arrange lighting? Where was it? Where did it happen? I need the full story and pics.
This was in Nottingham, and it was February the 14th, 1980, in the 80s. And, that's it, really. And I put
but
on...
But where?
In my house.
In your house? Fine.
I had a house.
In a house.
Yeah, and I just remember putting on. It's the closing credit sequence to Amadeus, and it is just the most beautiful piece of music. So it's the Romanza from the 20th Piano Concerto. It's like the Intel music, and did the proposal there, one knee, all that jazz.
Wow.
What about you?
Well, the most, I mean, it's weird because it didn't seem like it at the time, but Linda and I got married in Liverpool. We actually got married across the water in the town hall, and we came back and we had our wedding reception in the Adelphi Hotel, which we thought to be very, very posh, but then was subsequently the subject of that TV show that was kind of, you know, behind the candelabra, really.
All right.
And then we had our reception in the evening upstairs above the Philadelphia, the Philharmonic pub, which got an upstairs room. Well, it was a gig's a gig, right? So I booked my band, the Bottlers, to play the reception
Did you pay yourself?
I think we paid the other members of the band. Okay. But what happened was that the Bottlers came over from Manchester to Liverpool in a Manchester Van Hire van, which I believe said Manchester Van Hire on the side of it. And they parked out back of the Adelphi whilst we were having the wedding lunch. Of course, the van got broken into and all the instruments got nicked. Of course they did. It was a Manchester Van Hire van parked out the back of the Adelphi in Liverpool, full of course it got burgled. And so everything worked out fine because we put out a call to our friends saying, look, we've had lost all our equipment and not my double bass instead, because nobody in their right mind would steal a double bass. We managed to get enough instruments to play the thing. But in the middle of the afternoon, we had to go to the Nick to report the theft. And so our wedding photographs include a picture of Linda in her fantastic wedding dress in the Nick.
Is this the most romantic thing you've ever done?
And I remember saying to her, I'm so sorry. And she went, you're kidding? Who else's wedding album's got this in it?
That's very true.
And I thought that was actually one of the most romantic things ever. Okay, was.
That leads us on to our, quite usefully, to Siobhan in Norfolk's question.
Okay.
What's the closest you've ever come to getting arrested?
Oh, I've been arrested.
Okay, what were you arrested for? Being a trot?
Yeah, you know, being in possession of a placard which said, smash everything now.
Why, but properly, why were you arrested?
Well, exactly that. There was some picket or other, something, and we all got, this is Manchester in the 1980s. Bear in mind, this was under James Anderton.
Was it an illegal picket? You got to be arrested for, so you obviously broke the law.
No, well, here's what happened. We got picked up, right? We got put in the back of a van, and we got driven somewhere, anchored somewhere, and then they let us out. So literally what they did was they picked us up, you know, blah, 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 put us in the back, and we drove.
Say, you're nicked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, got your bank, and then they just let you out, and then find your own way home. It was a fairly, back then, policing was a little bit, you know, make it up, particularly in Manchester. But Manchester policing under James Anderton was particularly bizarre. I nearly got nicked. If it's the closest you ever got to being nicked without being nicked, in Oakley Park in the 1970s, me and my friend Simon used to go to the park of an evening to talk about life, the universe and everything, not to do anything of any illegal nature at all, but just to talk, you know. And we were down there, and a local Bobby came along, and he thought that we were clearly up to no good. And he asked me what my name was. And my name back then was Mark Ferry. I changed my name after my parents got divorced. I took my mother's maiden name. And I said, Ferry. And he said, right, if you're going to be like that, you're coming. I mean, that is my name.
So you just annoyed.
Yeah, but that's the nearest I got. Right. But, so, you know.
As opposed to being pushed in a van and then dumped somewhere else.
Although I've never been charged or anything, you know.
The nearest I got to getting nicked was, again, in Nottingham, being out for a night, I suppose. I think being in the pub. Anyway, I was a passenger in a car.
Right.
And so I would think I was in the back seat, and we went past some police. And at football matches, if you went to a football match in the 80s, whenever the police turned up, a lot of the crowd would go, la, 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 nick, 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 la, 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 nick, 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 nick. Right. So I started singing that and pointing at the police. And I was singing, la, 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 nick, 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 and pointing. They stopped the car, hauled me out, and they said...
You said, but I'm the nation's favourite broadcaster, soon to be.
Anyway, and this guy said, you were giving me the V's. You were sticking the V's up. I said, no, I wasn't. I was pointing a finger. I was going, nick, 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 nick. He said, I saw you. You were giving me the V's. I said, I was not. Anyway, he said, you were. And I went, okay.
Your word against his?
Don't do it again. I won't. I got back in the car.
Well done. Off.
But I wasn't. I'm still annoyed.
Okay. Do you know the old joke about how many Manchester policemen does it take to change a light bulb?
I think I'm about to be told.
Four. Three to smash the light bulb. No, one to smash the light bulb, and three to stand up in court and swear the light bulb started it.
This is an interesting line of conversation. Thank you, Ellie and Anne. Thank you, Siobhan in Norfolk. Scott says, Mark, your recent musings on the lifelong effects of The Exorcist led to a mishearing and personal Mandela effect. Remind me what the Mandela effect is.
The Mandela effect is that people believe that they remember Nelson Mandela dying when he didn't. I mean, this is before he died. They remember his funeral, but they don't. It's okay. A kind of sort of common, but I remember it happening. No, you don't.
When you said the lady Erin Dawes first engaged you with, your thesis is haunted by Freud. I heard your feces is haunted by Freud and thought it quite a strange turn of phrase. I let it settle for a moment, then had to rewind and review. And upon re-listening, I realised it was thesis, but of course my mind insisted on feces and it also got rid of Freud. So I heard in my imagination, your feces is haunted by fraud. So, my question, what lyrics or quote have you misheard but refused to accept the intended enunciation? My own is Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something. When I heard I Remember the Film as I Remember the Bill, at the time I was not film literate, so I associated the line with a meal, not with a classic movie. And my question, what film, if any, do you not wish to view again because you cannot risk altering your memories of it? So my own would be Wings of Desire. I will cite this as my favourite film, although I have not viewed it for years. My memories are that it encapsulates the wistful, melancholic mood that is mine, and I am reluctant to see it again in case I shatter the illusion. So, well, let's do the last one. Is there a film that you don't want to watch again in case it's not as good as the way you remember
it? Well, there was a case of it for ages, which is, and I'm sorry, funnily enough, you and I were talking very briefly. This came up in the car, and it comes up time and time again, which is Jeremy. When I saw Jeremy, I was 12. And it had such a profound effect on me. And then I didn't see it for 40 years. And then I was programming some stuff for the QFT for Cinemagic. And they said, you know, what film would you like to program? And I said, well, you know, there is a film from my childhood, but you'll never find it. It's called Jeremy. And then they rang and said, we found not one, but two copies of it because it hadn't been available forever. And I hadn't seen it. And I said, oh, great, let's book that. And then I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I was about to introduce a film that I'd only seen once when I was 12 and I really, really loved it, but I hadn't seen it since then. And I had no idea whether it was going to be any good at all. So my introduction to it was basically an apology for it. And then, of course, I started watching it. And the minute it started, it was like I was 12 again. It was like I was right back. And I remember it almost frame for frame exactly as it was.
With that dreadful piece of music.
That lovely piece of music. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I was I was beside myself in tears, but I was so scared of coming into contact with it. And this came up before, I don't want to show it to anyone else in case they don't like it, because most people probably wouldn't.
Julian Evitts.
Have you got an example of that or not?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I tried to think of one,
but you couldn't think of one.
Dear teenage girl and not a teenage girl, I was reading this week about, you may well have heard this story, about how a German ballet company director smeared dog feces in the face of a critic who had written a negative review.
Yes.
I did hear this.
Yes, it was in the news, yeah.
So
it was on Thought for the Day this morning.
Oh, was it? Really?
Yeah.
The director, so here's the quote from the news. The director of a leading German ballet company has been suspended from his post and is being investigated by police after allegedly smearing a critic's face with his dog's excrement at the premiere of his new show after she described one of his productions as boring and disjointed. Marco Gurke, the head of Hanover State Opera's ballet company, has also been barred from the opera house, a spokesperson confirmed on Monday afternoon after he confronted Wiebke Huster, the ballet critic of Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, in the interval of his latest show on Sunday night. He attacked her verbally before producing a bag of dog feces from his pocket and rubbing the contents in her face. Reading this...
In her actual face?
Yes.
I thought he'd done it on a picture. He actually rubbed it in her actual face.
Yes. So that's like GBH, basically.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine. I'm sorry. I thought that the story was that he'd rubbed it on a picture of it. Okay,
no.
Fine.
Into the face of a critic. Reading this has caused me to wonder, what has been the worst reaction to a review that Mark has received or that he is aware of any other film critic receiving? So first of all, I mean, that is...
assault.
It is assault.
Open and closed case. Yes, it's assault,
which is why he's been suspended and so on.
Yeah.
But what's the worst reaction to a review that you've ever had?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer to this is Danny Dyer, who at several times has threatened to physically assault me, and this has been gleefully reported by newspapers like The Independent, who did a gleeful report of him saying, yeah, if I ever see him, it'll just be no talking, I'll just smash his, I'll break his nose. There was an appalling interview with him in the Radio Times in which the journalist, they just repeat all this stuff like it's perfectly fine. Now, I don't know Danny Dyer from a hole in the ground. I can't stand his films, but that's neither here nor there. He has threatened on several occasions to physically assault me. I mean, it's what are you going to do? It's like, how likely is this to happen? I'm sure he's, you know, what's the phrase? All mouth and no trousers. But anyway, but it's, I do remember thinking, I find this kind of quite tiresome that newspapers are just blithely reporting this stuff like there's no consequence to it. Saying you are going to physically assault somebody, whether you're going to do it or not, it's like, surely you shouldn't do that because it's not a very good idea. Anyway, so I remember that, but, you know, I it's kind of water off a duck's back because I'm sure that I can't imagine a case when it would ever actually happen. But he said it so many times and so often, and particularly there have been, I mean, I kind of find it more troublesome that the journalists who've reported it have reported it uncritically as a kind of, as a funny thing, you know. And he said, yeah, I'm going to physically beat him up. I'm going to break his nose. I'm going to do this, which is just being a dick, frankly. That's probably the way. I mean, beyond that, it's just people, you know, people get the hump, but that's fine. I mean, people getting the hump is fine. People, writing stuff about you, that's as bad as it's ever got. Nobody has ever, I mean, somebody punched me in the bar of the Corner House once years ago in Manchester over a review of Blue Velvet, but it wasn't really a punch. It was more of a sort of push or a shove or
Benedict
something.
Benedict Cumberbatch punch you lightly on the arm.
Yeah, but again, it was reported in The Independent that he'd punched somebody in the face. And it was like, no, you numbskulls. It's on YouTube. How hard is it to fact check this? And he did it as a kind of joke. But yeah, no, like I said, I think the only one is the, you know, the and it went on for quite a long time with Danny Dyer doing this. I am going to punch him. I will break his nose. I will stick something across his canister in a kind of grow up, you pathetic little child way.
Remember, as I believe I'm quoting Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania,
mm-hmm.
It's never too late to
stop being a... And incidentally, this was a while ago. He may well have stopped being a... since then. I don't know because I haven't seen him in a film in ages. People really liked him in EastEnders. So, you know, hey.
Chris and Peter, of all the great films I have seen, and by incontrovertible extension you have, the one Friends and I revisit more than any other is not one many people talk about. No doubt there is nostalgia for when we first watched it. No doubt there is some mocking of the less well-executed scenes. No doubt the source material, underlying story and cast are actually excellent. The film I'm talking about is 1996's A Time to Kill, adapted from a John Grisham novel of the same name by Joel Schumacher. It stars a young Matthew McConaughey, Kevin Spacey, Samuel L. Jackson.
Matthew McConaughey and his hair.
Sandra Bullock, Sutherland's Donald and Kiefer, Oliver Platt et al. We may now have watched it so many times, best guess would be 200 times.
Wow.
That alongside knowing every word, we know every bum note, every incongruity, every background idiosyncrasy, and yet we find something new each time. So, are there any disposable films which either of you revisit way beyond their profile or perceived merit? Do you think we would find the same renewed joy from adopting any other well-made film, or might this be an undeservedly ignored film? Do you remember A Time to Kill?
I do remember A Time to Kill. It was, I think it was the point at which I started referring to him as your friend John Grisham.
For reasons I still don't understand.
Because I think you'd interviewed him or something, or anyway, whatever.
So is there a film which you revisit way beyond the perceived merit of the movie? Because you get something out of it.
Well, I mean, Love Actually, as we know, is kind of been critically panned, but I will watch it whenever it comes on television. Even for all the things that are right or wrong about it, I don't care. I just love it to pieces. I know there was a while when, for some reason, teenagers started rewatching Chef, you know, the Jon Favreau thing, over and over again. I could never quite figure out why. I know that Child 2 and his friends quite regularly rewatch films that they hold to be rubbish, but they just love watching them in all they go. I can't think of an example for me because I would say like Breathless by Richard Gere. I don't think it's bad.
Well, I would. The only thing I could think of was Parent Trap.
Oh yeah.
The Lindsay Lohan remake.
Yes.
which is...
It's a lovely film.
Yeah, but it's probably rubbish. I mean, I don't know. I just found it, you know, it's one of those films, certainly disposable, Chris and Peter, but worth revisiting because it's sort of...
It's a lovely film.
Charming. And maybe the Lindsay Lohan high point, which is...
Yeah, although, you know, she's having a bit of a career resurrection at the moment, and maybe she'll do something, you know, brilliant in the future.
Catherine, BSc, MSc, GCSE, French, grade B. I am trying... Oh, it starts, cher le bon docteur. I am trying to learn French for the first time since school, une éternité, and, and everyone to Le Monde says that watching films in French is a great way to improve.
Okay.
Are there any movies that you would recommend? Nothing so basic that it's boring, but nothing so nuanced that my schoolgirl French will miss the plot. I rewatched Tell No One this weekend and it was perfect, and Amélie is on my to-do list. Cordialement, Catherine. Yeah, I was going to pitch in Au revoir les enfants, which I remember seeing as a late 80s.
Yeah.
World War II
film. A classic.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Would you count a classic? Okay, yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. Anyway, so Catherine, that's what I'm suggesting. So, Au revoir les enfants.
So the criteria is simply...
A good movie in French so that she can learn her, improve her French.
Yeah. I mean, Au revoir les enfants is pretty hard stuff. I mean, there's like...
Manon des Sources
and Jean de Florette are both huge hits. And although, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say the greatest films ever made, they are films that are really, really popular. And I would probably go for them just because the chances of you enjoying them are very high, because people absolutely love those two films.
Helen. And obviously, if you want to suggest any other French film, we can pick this up next week. Correspondence at Kermit.com.
And I mean, also, I mean, you could, I mean, I suppose one could argue Abu Dussouf, because, you know, I said the Richard Gere thing beforehand, but Abu Dussouf is a really easy film to watch. It's kind of really easy to like.
Also, you could just as an exercise, you could watch a British movie, but choose the French dub.
Yeah.
Because a lot of movies will come with, you know, you can just select the French language.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you could watch Love Actually, the aforementioned.
Amour Actuellement.
And just have it in French, because I'm sure that you'll learn something. Helen, legacy listener, first time emailer. After recently watching Alex Garland's less ambiguous than the director perhaps thought, Men. Oh, I hated that film. I contemplated what would make an interesting companion movie to this. Although Midsommar immediately came to mind, it then struck me that Little Women, any version, though Greta Gerwig's recent version was exceedingly delightful and moving, would be the perfect companion for Men. Movie titles so closely linked, but thematically polar opposite films. Are there any such double bills? After Men, I wanted to watch On Golden Pond. Just the most kind of lose yourself in this kind of film, just to calm myself down from the trauma.
So basically two titles of two films that have a sort of similarity.
Or something to go with Men.
I
don't know, whatever, however you want to
respond. No, but the way that that was that Men and Little Women, because it's that the two are sort of, you know, The Big Blue and Blue. Derek Jarman's Blue and The Big Blue.
Okay. Henry says, I have quite recently become slightly fixated on George Romero's 1968 genre-setting Night of the Living Dead. I had watched it a few years ago, but not quite clicked with it, but rewatched it this past Halloween season and was really taken aback and confused by how I previously hadn't loved it. As well as setting the modern rules for zombies, here only called ghouls, it exhibits the common tropes we expect of a zombie film. Characters stranded in a location, disagreeing with each other, boarding up and fortifying, improvising weapons, making breaks for escape that go badly. I've watched it a few times more since that revelatory viewing, and have watched the documentary Birth of the Living Dead. The making of the film is a lovely story involving the people of Pittsburgh chipping in to help the film, and actor-producer Gary Striner winning the sound mix for the film in a chess game. And in keeping with the common occurrence in your show, bought the film adjacent board game, Night of the Living Dead, a zombicide game.
Wow.
Which my flatmates and I have enjoyed. My question for presumably Mark, you're correct, Henry, is what else might I be able to do to indulge this obsession? Any more reading or watching that you'd recommend around this film?
Well, look, there's so much written about the Romero, well, you know, the whole zombie series. There are some great articles by Alan Jones, who, you know, became very close to George Romero. Obviously, read Kim Newman's Nightmare Movies, which has it in that section, which, because Kim's got a kind of, you know, fantastic appreciation of Night of the Living Dead. All that stuff, like, you know, the Return of the Living Dead movies, the ones that are kind of not the Romero's, but the, you know, the other sort of thing, always proved something of a distraction. There is, weirdly enough, because they are connected. There's that Brian Usner Return of the Living Dead Part 3, which is Romeo and Juliet. But I think the best thing is I would read Kim Newman's Nightmare Movies.
Okay.
You probably have done already, but it was reissued a few years ago in a kind of updated edition, and Kim writes absolutely beautifully about those films. And then Alan Jones's articles about Romero.
Henry also has a schmestion. Brought on by finding your accounts of your dreams very entertaining. And are there any more dreams that you've had that might have plagued you for a long time? And at risk of interfering with Mark's therapy, I'd be interested to hear more from his dream journal. The only dream that occurred to me, having had Nick Robinson trying to assassinate me with his sniper's rifle.
So specific.
Very, very weird. Was I actually wrote a book based on a dream that I'd had.
Really?
Yes. I woke up having had a very vivid dream that I was in a queue waiting to go to prison, and I was going to prison for something that my grandfather had done, and I couldn't quite remember what it was.
And that was the inspiration? Wow.
That was where, so I then thought that was an interesting idea. So I wrote a book called Blame, which was based on that becoming a law in a couple of years' time, that if your parents or grandparents had committed a crime and got away with it.
What was the phrase you used? Not inherited.
Heritage crime.
Heritage crime. That was a heritage crime.
I called
it
heritage crime. And it was an idea which had started in America, and then we'd adopted it because we were at the European Union. And da, 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 da. Anyway, so that's the only other dream that I can remember that sort of stayed with me, that I did anything with, because I thought, okay, well, I'll turn that into a very, very entertaining book.
I mean, I've had loads of dreams. The thing that I have most recurrently is trying to find somewhere a bedroom to sleep in, but the rooms are absolutely full of clutter and stuff, and sometimes the floor will be on the shonk, so I'm kind of rolling off it. And I had one quite recently in which I ended up upstairs in an attic bedroom that had a leaky sink, and the water was flowing out of the sink, and it was flowing onto the floor, and I was gathering up my possessions to try and get, you know, whatever I had off the floor, and I was on the bed, and then I realized that sticking out of the top of the bed was the hand of an old woman who was in the bed, and I hadn't noticed. And then I realized that there was a floorboard, and as the floorboard, underneath the floorboard, there was like a kind of Frankenstein's monster thing.
Way too much horror in this dream.
Yeah. But what was interesting was that I wasn't scared by them, because I realized that they lived there. It was their home. It was, and I was the interloper, and I shouldn't have been in there because I was disturbing them. And then this woman, who I think owned the house, opened the door and said, "What are you doing in here?" And I said, "Well, you told me to come up here." She said, "No, I didn't. You've come here to sing. Now sing." And I thought, I can't sing. She said, "Come and sing." And I started to sing Withered and Died, the Richard Thompson song. And I couldn't. My voice, and it was around the time that you had lost your voice through your cold.
Strange.
And I tried to sing and I couldn't
very
sing.
Specific.
And I know that I can sing that song, but I couldn't sing it. And I did discuss it afterwards with my therapist, and she said, "Yeah, you're as mad as a box of frogs."
Thank you. That'll be 50 quid. Finally, let's just do this one. Ed.
That's When the Music Takes Me. That's the Neil Sedaka record that I bought.
I mean, that took a while.
Yeah.
It's not a very short title, though.
It's not. No, it's not. That is the word I was thinking of. You know.
Dear Epic Tales and Epic Fails, I heard Mark mention vacuum theory last week. Just remind me about vacuum theory.
Well, I first heard the theory in the NME Book of Rock, and it was the entry describing Queen as having been the beneficiaries of vacuum theory, which was that they became as famous as they did because there was a hole in the British rock market that they filled. This, incidentally, was an analysis that did not age well. It turned out that the person that wrote it was being silly. But it's you, in terms of cinema, vacuum theory is you go and see that children's movie because there isn't any other children's movie playing.
I recently took my children to the cinema because I love to go and they love to go. They are 12 and 14, so I'm restricted to a 12A or lower. This is where the vacuum theory becomes a trial. On going to the cinema, this means I'm often hemmed into going to see superhero films or animations. Don't get me wrong, I've seen good examples of both, but these are often exceptions. On this occasion, the only alternative to these twin disappointments was the Fablemans, which worried me. Would they sleep through the whole thing? Reviews had been lukewarm. Actually, I shouldn't have worried. It was great. Both children stayed awake and absolutely enjoyed it, as did I. And that final scene in Cameo had me roaring with laughter. No spoilers, but it's fantastic.
But it is fantastic.
In all, it was wholesome, engaging and entertaining and had depth. But why do so few 12A films manage to achieve this? The last time we could all enjoy a film together like this was to see Leave No Trace. Such findings are scarce. Several times I have planned to take the kids to the cinema and given up because of the lackluster fare at 12A or below. So thank you, Steven Spielberg, for your film. Can we please have more films for children that are not inane, please? Yeah. So that's not really a question. It's just more of an observation.
But I'll tell you what, there is an answer to your question. The problem with the 12A certificate, or in America its counterpart, which is the PG-13, is that it is the box office sweet spot in terms of blockbuster movies. So if you are making Star Wars, Marvel, Spider-Man, you know, something like that, it has to be 12A or PG-13 in order to maximize the box office. And what those films often are is films that they're not children's films, but they're films that have been designed to get in, to attract the widest possible audience while simultaneously trying to be something else. I mean, as Michael Douglas was saying, he seemed quite surprised when he said, you hear about these, Comic-Cons? It's like grown-ups, they take comics really seriously. So the problem with that category is that it becomes the kind of the middle-of-the-road category into which you try and get. If a film's going to cost you $200 million to make, it's going to have to be a 12A or a PG-13, or you are going to struggle to make it back. I mean, that is why something like, you know, Exorcist becoming as successful as it was when it was an R-rated film in America and an X-rated film over here is remarkable, because so much of the audience, you know, was out. The 12A has always been the bodge certificate. It is the no man's land in which you can say, you know, SHIT once, twice, but not three times, but you can't use it. You know what I mean? And it's quite often films that are one thing pretending to be another thing. So it is the real hodgepodge. There has been an absolute dearth of great cinema intended for younger audiences. We just don't have it in the way that we used to. I mean, remember the days of the Children's Film Foundation when Mark Jenkin was doing his season for the BFI, the cinematic DNA of Ennis, Maine. He was looking to Children's Film Foundation's films, as so many people who started watching movies in the 1970s were doing. Those things don't exist really anymore.
Okay, so interesting fair. Ed, thank you very much for your question. If you have a question or indeed a schmestion, we would like to tackle it next week. So you send it to correspondence@kermanandmayo.com. I think we're done. We'll be with you with a brand new take one and take two.
A brand new That's Where the Music Takes Me One.
Kenobi.